This podcast contains descriptions of violence against children and adult language and is not suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Hi everyone, and welcome to Groomed to Die, the Kenzia Children, the first ever Suffer the Little Children podcast miniseries. I'm your host, Lane, and this is part two, The Trial. Last week, I told you the story of Michael and Kevin Kenzia, two baby boys adopted 9 months apart by Susan and Tom Kenzia. Michael and Kevin also died 9 months apart, each just 2 months after his adoption, under suspicious circumstances. The death of a second adopted baby in the Kenzia home led to an investigation into both deaths. In this episode, I'll go into the aftermath of Michael and Kevin's deaths, the criminal charges that resulted, the weird relationship between Susan and her defense attorney, Ken Usner, Susan's murder trial, and the shocking outcome that allowed Susan to continue her pattern of alleged child abuse, deception, and pure evil for decades to follow. This is part two, The Trial. Quick shout out today to my newest patron, Jane W. from Brooklyn, New York. Thank you so much, Jane. If you'd like to help me keep the show going, you can do so at either patreon.com/stlcpod or at ko-fi.com/stlcpod. If you haven't yet listened to part one of the miniseries, Michael and Kevin, I definitely recommend doing that before listening to this part. Today, I'll pick up where I left off last week, when I told you that after Kevin's death, the investigation into Michael's was reopened. In the Commonwealth of Virginia, most criminal charges start with an arrest warrant being issued for an individual, who is then entitled to a preliminary hearing at the general district court level. However, direct indictment can be handed down even if the person is not aware they were under investigation. At a grand jury hearing, the prosecution presents its case, and the grand jury hears testimony from police officers and others. The standard of probable cause is a fairly low bar because the grand jury isn't deciding on the guilt or innocence of the accused. If the grand jury finds probable cause to charge the individual, the proposed charge is entered as a true bill and brought directly before a circuit court. Direct indictments allow prosecutors to circumvent the general district court and the preliminary hearing. Very few criminal charges in Virginia begin this way. Sometimes, if an individual has been charged with a felony, but the charges were dismissed at the General District Court preliminary hearing, the Commonwealth's attorney or prosecutor can seek an indictment from a grand jury. In the case of Susan Kenzia, it's possible that Commonwealth's attorney W. Parker Counsel sought a direct indictment because he declined to charge Susan after the initial investigation into Michael's death. It's hard to say, and the family has been unable to reach counsel for comment. He did say in July of 1986 that he regretted his decision not to prosecute Susan earlier for Michael's murder. At a secret hearing in July of 1986, an Isle of Wight County grand jury heard testimony from Smithfield Police Lieutenant W. Charles Phelps, Special Agent James Huddle of the Virginia State Police, three civilian witnesses, and a 14-year-old former foster child who lived with the Kenzias for about a month right around the time Kevin was adopted into the family. Evidently, what the grand jury heard was damning enough to issue a direct indictment against Susan Lee Stevenson Kenzia. On July 7, 1986, Susan was arrested at her home on Riverside Drive in Smithfield, Virginia. She was booked into the Suffolk County Jail in Suffolk, Virginia on 2 counts of murder, one for the death of 9-month-old Michael, and one for the death of 4.5-month-old Kevin. Her bail was set at $100,000. Because the direct indictment eliminated the need for a preliminary hearing, the public would not learn the details of the case until Susan's trial. After Susan's arrest, her daughters, 7-year-old Christy and 5-year-old Shannon, were sent to live with relatives in South Carolina. They were supposed to stay with their Mimi and Papa, Susan's parents, Betty and Marion Stevenson, but instead they ended up staying with Susan's sister, their Aunt Renee. This was an incredibly problematic placement for reasons I'll explain in the next episode. Susan's defense attorney, Kenneth Usner of the Usner and Hardwick Law Firm, was a former New York State trooper who also spent 13 years on active duty with the Military Police Criminal Investigation Division. Mr. Usner was a retired U.S. Army colonel who served as a 101st Airborne Ranger. Regarding Susan's arrest, Usner told a reporter,
"Why did it take them 10 months to charge her? It doesn't make any sense if they've got a good case. You've got a woman who has adopted 2 children and lost them. It's a tragedy, not a crime."
The 10-month window he referred to was the time elapsed since Michael's death. I guess he didn't want to consider how much worse Kevin's death made things look for his client. That could have something to do with the ultra-creepy relationship he seemed to have with Susan. I believe they began working together soon after Michael's death, or during the first investigation in 1985. I'm in possession of several audio recordings of Mr. Usner's phone calls with various individuals. Susan herself hung on to the original audio tapes containing these calls. I'm going to play you various clips from the calls, because not only are they enlightening, they paint a very interesting picture of the time period, the case, and the parties involved. First, I'll pause here for a sponsor break. In this audio clip, defense attorney Ken Usner speaks with Susan's cellmate, Charlotte Brown.
Let me ask you a question.
Mm-hmm.
You think Susan did anything?
No.
What have you seen?
Down in my heart, I do not.
But you don't think that she did anything, huh?
No.
I don't think so either.
I know what she told me.
You're a pretty good old girl, isn't she?
Yes, she is.
Does she get depressed a lot?
Yep.
Is she crying?
Only when she talks about it.
Okay, baby, listen, I sure appreciate you talking to me. We're going to be able to get hold of you if we need you when you get out.
After speaking with Charlotte, Usner asks her to put Susan back on the phone, and we get this odd exchange.
Come out here, dying to meet you.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'll come down here and we'll bring some pizza, okay?
Okay.
Now, quit talking.
Uh-huh.
Quit talking about this thing. You're talking to Charlotte.
Mm-hmm.
Quit just talking, okay?
Uh-huh.
You're doing what I told you not to. You're running your mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yes.
Stop it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, baby?
Mm-hmm.
Got a smile?
Yes.
I can't hear it.
Sure you can.
I cannot hear it.
Hi, you can hear it.
Okay, now I can hear it. All right. Got you covered. Thank you, dear.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now you have a... Don't go getting fat on me in jail.
Getting fat?
Yeah.
Are you kidding? I haven't eaten since I've been in this place.
Okay. Well, I haven't eaten since you got charged.
You haven't?
No, did you notice the weight that I lost?
Well, I haven't really looked at your belly.
I have not. It ain't there.
Well, maybe that's why I haven't noticed.
It's not there.
Yeah.
I probably lost 15 pounds since you got charged.
Lost 15 pounds?
Yeah, at least.
Yeah, from Monday to Thursday, I lost 8 pounds.
Yeah, I know that. I'm in the same situation because I just can't eat. Every waking moment, my mind is on this.
Yeah. Well, after
Thursday,
we'll go out and eat.
Yeah, well, you like crab legs?
I love crab legs.
All right, after we get over with this thing, let's go out and let's see how many crab legs we can eat and how much fried shrimp we can eat, okay?
Okay.
We'll take your husband and my wife and Rick and his wife and anybody else you want to come.
Okay.
Okay, baby?
All right.
Talk to you later, sugar.
See you Wednesday.
Right, bye-bye.
Bye.
Just to put that into perspective, Susan claimed to be allergic to shellfish for Shannon's entire life, both before and after this phone call. In this clip, she gives explanations for some of Michael and Kevin's injuries.
Tell me about these rags that you're talking about in the kid's mouth, in Kevin's mouth.
Well, when he would spit up, I would wipe his mouth out, and he always chewed on cloth diapers.
He was stuffing in his mouth to stop crying?
Uh-uh. No, he would be crying when I do it, but I was just wiping the stuff out of his mouth.
Quick interjection here. Susan said she would wipe out Kevin's mouth when he was
stood up.
First of all, who wipes out the interior of their child's mouth? Second, how was a 4-month-old standing at all?
Were there stitches done on the inside of the mouth of Michael?
Yeah, he had 4 stitches in his bottom lip.
For what?
He had fell and hit his mouth. Is it on the walker or the busy box? Because he hit his mouth on both of them, but I don't remember which.
Well, he just, he wasn't, didn't have good motor coordination or what?
No, he didn't have any motor coordination.
Okay.
He had, I mean, he fell all the time. He hit his head on the crib. I don't know how many times he just... He was, the pediatrician said he was about 3 months behind in motor development.
What reason did he give?
He said it was either social deprivation or cerebral palsy.
Right. In this call, Susan is so bothered by the newspaper printing photos of Michael and Kevin's temporary grave markers that she says she's suffering from a terrible migraine.
Hello?
Hello? What you doing?
I'm just laying down.
What's this shit about Tylenol 3?
I can't hear you.
What's this shit about you taking Tylenol 3?
I've got a migraine headache.
All right, well, let the headache go away because we're okay.
I found out pictures of my baby's grave been in the paper.
That's true.
Hearing that people have said that I wanted my babies to revive them to practice CPR.
Oh, who said that?
It was the pastor there in the Virginia Pilot, so I heard.
Well, I got it right here.
Don't read it to me. I don't want to hear it.
I didn't see that.
We're going to have to put up a time shit. I don't want to go home, kid.
What's
wrong with him? I just said stay in here and have to put up with him.
What's that?
I don't know what his problem is. I've got a headache. So he jumps all in my shit and starts busting me and saying, you better get your act together. You better watch what you say and watch what you do. I know all that. Tell me first impressions are most important. You better not mess up tomorrow. I don't have anything to mess up. I am going to be so calm, they're not going to recognize me. But I don't need this shit. I just am staying here until this whole mess is over.
Okay, I understand what you're saying, but I need you out. You gotta get out from me.
I bet you want me to stay in.
Till Thursday, Friday! Need you out, baby.
Why?
Well, you brighten up my life.
I'll brighten up your life? You brighten up my life, kid.
Right.
That's why she called. She said, he'll make you smile.
Well, it's true. I'm just an old fart.
Just an old fart?
Yeah, I'm just an old fart. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
It's a situation here where you're starting to play their game.
I know, I'm falling in the trap they want me to. But that's not why I've got a murdering headache. I was upset because that was in the paper. I can't believe that they would stoop so low. But then nothing surprises me anymore.
What'd they do? Tell me what?
Huh?
Tell me what was that?
I'm just talking about the fact they put my baby's grave's picture in the paper.
I'm sitting here looking at it.
I mean, that's low. And I talk to Tom and he jumps on this shit. I don't need it, Ken.
I understand what you're saying.
That's the point. I don't care.
Well, don't take that attitude. We're going to be okay.
I'm not worried about the trial. I'm not worried about anything. I just don't feel like putting him in his shit. I know it's hard on him. But I don't need him jumping on me. He's telling me you can do better. I think I'm doing pretty damn good under the circumstances.
There's a method to my madness. Part of my madness and part of my method is to tell you to take your head out of your ass.
My head ain't in my ass.
Well, it is if you start letting them do what they're trying to do.
No, that's not like that to me. I mean, it upset me the fact they would do that.
Who is they?
The newspaper.
Then be pissed at the newspaper. Don't be pissed at the system.
Oh, I'm not. That's not what I'm talking about. That's what I'm talking about. I'm pissed at the newspaper.
Right.
They would stoop so low, something like that.
They had nothing else to write on. We wouldn't give them anything.
I know, but see, I got over that. And then I talked to Tom and he said all this shit. That's what I'm mad about.
We're going to be okay.
Oh,
right. Sugar bud.
Oh, okay.
All right, you plug up, cheer up, and I'll see you in the morning, okay?
Okay.
Okay, baby?
Uh-huh.
Where's your smile?
It's there.
I can't hear it, Susan.
Okay, it's there.
It's there. All right. Okay?
Uh-huh.
Talk to you shortly, cutie.
See you in the morning.
Okay, baby. Bye-bye.
Here, Susan tells Usner about a letter she received from an unsavory admirer and complains that things were rocky at home.
I got a letter in the mail today.
Oh.
James Dix.
Who's that?
He's in the jail here for rape and murder.
Yeah?
I don't, you know, somebody finds out about this, it's not going to be too good.
What does it say?
Well, it's just, you may read it to you?
Yeah.
It's just Susan, while laying around here doing nothing, and after I read about you and saw you in the hall the other day, I thought that I would drop you a line or two to see how you were doing and maybe get to know you a little better. My name is James Diggs, and although this may sound a little corny, I know a little about what you are going through. Just hang in there and things will get better eventually.
Maybe one day we can even meet each other face to face on the outside. If you feel like it, drop me a line back and tell me a little about yourself. You really are a very pretty lady that shouldn't have to be in a place like this. If you need cigarettes or anything, let me know and I'll get you some. Or if you need anything, just let me know. To take care of yourself and I'll see you around. My name and section number will be on the outside of the envelope.
I don't see anything bad about it. You guys trying to get weighed.
But Tom has got to be told what to do, Ken, because he's got his head between his ass. He cannot function.
Right,
and I can't call him from here.
Give me his number.
Sorry to keep bothering you.
That's okay. You're not bothering me at all. Since you're working on you. We sent two divorces out here this morning to another water.
Maybe work on another one.
And we'll see about that when we get through all this shit. I mean, I ain't in no position to make any type of judgment call at all. All right, the only thing to do is I'll try to get hold of Tom. You try to get hold of Tom until you get off his dead butt, okay?
Yeah.
Don't worry about the letter. The letter don't mean shit unless you answer it. You're not stupid enough to answer it. He's just a masher. Okay?
Yeah.
All right, talk to you shortly, sugar.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
In all of these calls, Usner had a decidedly lecherous way of talking to women, particularly Susan. My skin wanted to crawl off my body while listening to these tapes. Listen to the end of another call in which they discussed Susan's bail.
Have a good one. It'll be okay. Where's your smile?
It's gone, Ken.
No, come on. Get it back.
I can't.
Come on. I've lost 18 pounds over you. You can't do that. Let me do the worrying. It's good for me. My doctor says it never looked better. You just keep worrying about this lady. She says you're doing a good job. Before you need to lose another 8 pounds. I said, okay, I'll do it. Okay?
Yeah.
Lord willing, the creek don't rise. By Monday morning, I'll be 222. This morning, I was 232.
Yeah.
Okay? Which is a whole lot better than last week when I did at 252. All right?
You weigh that much?
Yeah, I was at 249.5 pounds last day, 2 weeks ago, when this thing broke. Okay?
Yeah.
Sitting on my fat and duff trying to shuffle papers down about here.
Yeah, I've got you working.
Bricks. Yeah, you got me working.
I put you to work.
You got my full attention, too.
Usner also recorded a phone call between himself and Virginian Pilot reporter Anita Lee, who sent Susan a letter in jail offering to help her tell her story. I have a lot of comments to make about this one, most of which I'll keep to myself.
We're off the record, is that right?
Right.
Okay, off the record, my client didn't do nothing.
Uh-huh.
Off the record, no crime has been committed. 2 children died.
Uh-huh.
Off the record, this whole thing is such a travesty, it's unreal. It's just absolutely unbelievable. Off the record, I'm going for a bond reduction tomorrow morning.
Okay.
And this whole thing is a tragedy, off the record.
Mm-hmm.
This woman did not do this. This woman has passed 7 polygraph tests.
Hey, I wonder if this was off the record.
How many polygraphs did she pass?
7. Off the record, okay?
Right.
I don't know what the hell, you have to excuse me because I'm just a poor country boy from upstate New York. I don't know what the hell these sons of bitches want from this person.
Take this with a grain of salt, but many narcissists, sociopaths, and psychopaths have successfully passed polygraph tests with great ease.
You're gonna know my stuff. This woman's not guilty.
Mm-hmm.
She wasn't guilty of the first one. They haven't got any more information on the first one now than they had now when they dropped the charges. Off the record, which we still are, right?
Mm-hmm.
Off the record, they haven't even got a... They don't even have an autopsy report back on the second child.
Yeah.
Do you know what this thing is all about off the record?
What?
They pulled her through such a knothole, through such an emotional turmoil after the first one died, that when the second baby died of sudden infant death syndrome, which is what the doctor said it was, they came to the house 3 days later, the cops came to the house 3 days after the second baby died. And off the record, the husband stood there and said, "What do you want?" And the lieutenant who stood there, who's accused this woman of having affairs with other people, which she has not.
Charlie Phelps.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Off the record, he was very arrogant, very nasty. And off the record, my client's husband said, "I'm not going to let you talk to her because all you're going to do is upset her." And they said, "Well, there's questions that have to be asked." And then off the record, my client stood there and said, "Look, if you got a warrant, okay. If you don't have a warrant, get off my property and don't come back until you got one." At which time, Phelps turned around and told him, "I will be back with a warrant." Off the record, okay?
I've got the impression that this conversation is off the record, so you can drop that if you want.
Okay. But, you know, that's what this is all about. They are convinced that first child was ill. You know that? Isn't that a travesty? Never told the adoption agent, the people that were adopting the child, that the child had a nervous system disorder. Isn't that a travesty?
Well, now the coroner says he didn't, the medical examiner says he didn't find any pre-existing medical condition.
Well, what we're talking about is a nervous system disorder, which could be a brain dysfunction. This was why she kept getting the kid to the doctor, because he kept turning blue. She kept complaining to the doctor that the kid kept falling down. He's 18 months old, and he is not motivating. He doesn't have the motor capabilities of an 18-month-old.
The woman's own lawyer didn't even know the accurate age of the child in question. Michael was 9 months old. Kevin was 4.5 months.
My client, off the record, has been to a psychiatrist, and because she has had such a burning desire all of her life to have a son. She wants to go to the basketball game. She wants to see the kid excel in football and baseball. My client is really athletically inclined. And she's always wanted a son, this burning desire to have a baby. She can't have anymore. She's had two, which have never been shown any signs of abuse.
I would pay to be a fly on the wall while Usener listened to the next episode of this miniseries. I have never wanted more to watch someone eat their words.
Is there any way that you would talk to me on the record, or are you just...
You give me a list of questions that you want answered in writing, okay? And I'll give you a list of answers in writing.
Okay.
Okay.
Regarding those questions Mr. Usener said he would have his client answer, Anita Lee did send over a list of 42 questions, including, why did you want to adopt a child when you have two natural children? Why did you want a biracial child? Who was in your home at the time of Michael's death? How do you account for Michael's bruises, especially on his penis? Will you relate what happened to Julie Bates the day you called the rescue squad? Were you emotionally prepared to adopt a second child after your release from the hospital? Of those 42 questions, Susan answered 6, as follows. What brought you to the Smithfield area?
Married Tom, who lived here.
How long have you lived in Smithfield?
3 years.
What type of investigation did you have to go through before becoming eligible for an adopted child?
Usual exhaustive Social Security investigation.
How are you able to cope with the situation?
I haven't done anything wrong.
Do you believe that you will be acquitted?
Yes, because I am innocent, not guilty. How are you being treated? Great. All the deputies and police officers, the other prisoners, could not be any better for me.
In a brief phone call with reporter Steve Wingfield, Usener told him the same thing that he told Anita Lee, off the record, at the beginning of their call.
You know, I'm going to tell you the truth, okay? I don't think the woman did it, period. I don't think the crime has been committed, period. I just don't believe it. You can put that on the record, okay?
I think you'll find this call between defense attorney Ken Usener and Commonwealth's attorney or prosecutor, W. Parker Counsel, quite interesting, not to mention ethically problematic.
I don't understand this, Parker. I've got complete opposite reactions from this woman that I've ever had from any other criminal case.
Well, have you surveyed much of the literature on the sort of syndrome, assuming she did something?
No, I haven't.
These people are really don't behave like, even like normal crazies. I mean, they're totally different category.
What am I looking at, do you think?
I think I don't know. I mean, I'm not enough of a medical. I haven't got that
to me. I realize that.
It looks like what they call, what's the name of it? Munchausen.
Do you think that's what we're dealing with?
It looks an awful lot like it, yeah. It really does. I mean, I think there's something here going on. It's not just an ordinary homicide, obviously.
Are you convinced the crime has been committed, guy? This is off the record.
Well, I'm convinced that it's not a case of coincidental natural causes.
Is the second baby bruised?
The second baby, I think, was suffocated. Yeah, I think maybe the first baby perhaps was, too.
The child wasn't alone in that room.
Well, it doesn't take much.
I'm saying, the child was not alone in that room.
Yeah, I know.
How far are you going to be pushing 8-year-old?
Well, that was my concern the first time, less so now.
Let's talk about this as me being a cop and you being the my Commonwealth attorney. How far are you going to be pushing 8-year-old?
Well, I don't know. It's a good question.
We got a juvenile officer in Smithfield. Can we get a state juvenile officer.
You mean to interview the issue?
Yep.
I'm sure we can.
Can we do that together? Because if something's been done here, and I know we all want to know about it.
Yeah.
Just a thought. I'll give you a call back on it.
Yeah. I was looking for that the medical name for that.
You realize how many phone calls I've had? At least 80.
From who?
People in the community. People in South Carolina telling me this woman couldn't do it.
Although I was highly entertained by counsel's comment about not paying much attention to anything Susan told him, I still have some serious concerns about that call. After the investigation into Michael's murder, Susan and Tom received a letter from attorney Kenneth Usner, dated January 8, 1986, in which the attorney stated,
"Dear Susan and Tom, greatly pleased to be able to pass on to you the information which I received from the Smithfield Police Department, wherein they have decided not to place any charges against either one of you in reference to the death of your son. This decision on the part of the Smithfield Police Department was reached after they presented the case to the Portsmouth Commonwealth's attorney, due to the fact that the Smithfield Commonwealth's attorney felt that he was too close to both of you to render an impartial decision in this matter. Consequently, we can state that we have an absolute impartial review of the case and that you have been found without fault."
Portsmouth is an independent city in Virginia that is not located within a county, whereas Smithfield is located in Isle of Wight County. This leads me to believe the Smithfield Commonwealth's attorney in question was W. Parker Counsel, the Isle of Wight County Commonwealth's attorney. For counsel to decline to make a decision in the initial investigation into Michael's death because he felt he was too close to Susan and Tom really makes me wonder if he should have prosecuted these cases at all. Both Susan and her husband Tom told the media and the police that Michael and Kevin were victims of sudden infant death syndrome, or SIDS, which is the unexpected and unexplained death of an infant younger than a year old. The ruling of SIDS is only given after an autopsy and full investigation failed to reveal the child's cause of death. Dr. Farooq Preswala, who conducted Michael's autopsy in August of 1985, publicly refuted the SIDS theory. He had already told a reporter in October of 1985,
"This baby had a lot of bruises, and by definition it cannot be SIDS. Whatever the child had, it did not get bruises from it. Bruises mean injuries, and that is what is being investigated."
On July 8, 1986, Dr. Preswala told a Rock Hill Herald reporter that Michael's bruises
suggested the injuries occurred over time. The autopsy showed the infant died of injuries, and those injuries did not occur by natural means.
Dr. Hal Anderson, a pediatrician at the Piedmont Medical Center in Rock Hill, South Carolina, also spoke with a reporter. For kids who did die of SIDS, he said,
"The autopsies are basically unremarkable. No bruises, physical findings totally unremarkable. No physical symptoms at all."
He said the only warning of imminent SIDS death would be a previous SIDS death in the same family. Two SIDS deaths involving two adopted children
would be unusual, but that's not to say it couldn't happen.
It's worth pointing out that Michael and Kevin were not biologically related in any way. Dr. Anderson couldn't cite statistics about SIDS deaths in biracial children, but he cited an overall incidence of 1.522 SIDS deaths per 1,000 live births, 1.3 deaths in 1,000 live births of white babies, and 2.9 deaths per 1,000 live births of black babies. Another individual sought out by the media for his comments was Susan's father, Marion Stevenson, who was a maintenance mechanic for the Celanese Corp's Cell River plant, an acetate plant that closed for good in 2005. Marion learned of his daughter's arrest the day it happened when she called him from jail. He and his wife, Betty, immediately drove to Smithfield, but because they couldn't afford to post bail for Susan,
"We came back because there wasn't anything we could do. Working people don't have $100,000 lying around. They won't let us see her. They won't even let her husband see her."
He would be visiting Susan on Wednesday, which was visiting day at the jail, and he promised to fight the case hard in court and out.
"I'm not going to have somebody slandering my daughter."
Marion told the Herald his daughter was innocent and that both Michael's and Kevin's biracial backgrounds were compatible with conditions that could lead to SIDS. Marion also said that the bruises Dr. Preswala described in Michael's autopsy report were symptomatic of SIDS, which is one of the most ludicrous things I've ever heard, and I'd love to know who told him that. He also told the newspaper that Kevin had suffered some type of nervous disorder since birth, which we haven't heard up till this point about Kevin. Besides, Marion said, the murder indictments made no sense when held up against Susan's history with children, including her own two daughters.
"She's been dedicated to children all her life. The DSS people often come to her,"
he said, when it came to taking foster children and for advice. I'll let you decide if, realistically, the Department of Social Services was likely to go to Susan Kenzia, high school graduate and business school dropout, whose only certification was in CPR, for advice. George Geis, Susan's friend and Tom's co-worker who Susan met during her psychiatric hospitalization in early 1986, also spoke to a reporter, explaining why he thought Susan called her family doctor the morning of Kevin's death.
"She said there was no sense in calling the rescue squad because she knew the baby was dead. She had seen a dead baby before."
George said he didn't believe the sensitive and thoughtful person he knew could kill her own children.
"If she was capable of killing the first one, why in the hell did they give her the second child? She didn't do it because I know her."
A lot of people wondered the same thing. Adoption agency officials and investigators reviewed the case, trying to determine just how the second adoption came about after the first adopted child died under suspicious circumstances in Susan's care. Jane Henkel, a welfare services specialist in the Tidewater Regional Office of DSS, said that in regard to a second adoption, after Michael's death was investigated as suspicious,
"Any agency would look deeply into that. If this comes to an agency's attention, and it should, they would certainly go more deeply into it than a routine home study."
She said that Susan's hospitalization for psychiatric problems should also have raised red flags. Remember, Susan was released from that hospitalization less than a month before Kevin was placed into the Kenzia home.
If it comes to the attention that there are some psychiatric problems, the agency would look into it. That's really something you would need to know.
According to Ms. Hankel, a foster or adopted child would not be placed in any home where there was a record or even a suspicion of child abuse or neglect. She said Michael's suspicious death and Susan's psychiatric treatment should have been uncovered in interviews by a social worker before Kevin was placed in the home, but obviously this wasn't the case. Gloria Wilson, the social worker who oversaw both of the boys' placements with the Kenzia family, would not comment when a reporter asked if she was involved in Michael's and Kevin's adoptions. It wouldn't be long before her involvement was confirmed, however. On July 16, 1986, Susan and her attorney told the media they were seeking to lower her bond. In response, Commonwealth's attorney Parker Counsel said he probably wouldn't oppose the motion. At that point, Kevin's cause of death had not yet been determined. The medical examiner's office in Norfolk was investigating, and the final results of Dr. Wanger's autopsy weren't expected to be released for another 2 weeks or so. Meanwhile, officials from the Department of Social Services in Isle of Wight County, Grayson County, and the Tidewater Regional Office cited adoption confidentiality when they refused to disclose information about why a second child was placed into the Kenzia home despite the death of the first child. Chairman of the Isle of Wight Welfare Board, C. Fred Bailey, told the Daily Press that the situation and the county department's involvement were discussed by the board during a closed session on July 15th. He said that County Attorney Woodrow Crook told the board not to discuss specifics of the Kenzia case because it was being tried in criminal court. He also cited a 1976 law that forbade confirming or denying whether someone had been a client of the agency. Confirming what Gloria Wilson refused to confirm the week before, Chairman Bailey told the newspaper he was satisfied that Gloria had provided sufficient information about the investigation into Michael's death to officials in Grayson County, where Kevin was born.
She reported all the facts she knew about the investigation, and she knew it all, to those who asked for a report. The people with the child may have overlooked it. They were given the information and may have drawn their own conclusions.
According to Chairman Bailey, Linda Bean, Social Services Director for Isle of Wight, told him,
"As far as she could determine, the case was handled properly by her staff. Neither child was placed by Isle of Wight County."
He said that in regard to the Kenzia case, the Welfare Board did not take any action on the matter. On July 17, 1986, Susan was released from jail after her bond was reduced from $100,000 to $50,000, or $25,000 for each murder count. Rather than staying at her home with her husband, Susan actually went to stay with her cousin in a cabin in the woods. While her younger daughter, Shannon, was being molested on a daily basis by a family member in South Carolina, Susan was drinking, horseback riding, and enjoying her complete and utter freedom. The following week, the Daily Press published an editorial about the Kenzia case, titled Adoption Investigation. A drop head in the center of the page read,
"Something went wrong in the Kenzia case."
The editorial discussed why the Kenzias were allowed to adopt a second child after Michael's death was investigated as suspicious. One part that stood out read,
"Mrs. Kenzia may not be convicted of anything. She may not be guilty of anything. The appearances may be deceiving. The evidence may be circumstantial. But with such circumstances, there can be no denying that something, somewhere, went wrong with the adoption process. Either the procedures are not strict enough, or someone did not follow them. It is up to the state, which supervises departments of social services, and perhaps up to the courts, to determine where that failure occurred, and to ensure that it does not happen again. It will not do to say this case fell through the cracks. When it comes to children and adoption, there shouldn't be any cracks."
No argument here. At the time, DSS was investigating why Kevin's adoption was allowed to take place despite the circumstances surrounding Michael's death. The state agency's assistant director of communications, Ms. Lineberry, told a newspaper reporter that the Kenzia case appeared to be unique because the agency had no record of parents being allowed to adopt a second child after another adopted child died under circumstances that led to a police investigation.
"Fortunately, nothing like this has ever happened before, and I would hope it never would again. We certainly wouldn't let something like this go by without trying to find out what happened, and if we slipped up, whether changes need to be made to the written policy to ensure it never happens again."
Ms. Linneberry said she couldn't go into specifics about the Kenzia case because
adoption records are treated with a great deal of confidentiality.
The results of the DSS investigation as well would not be made public. The newspaper article added that a child welfare worker in Newport News who placed foster kids into the Kenzia home after Michael's death was not told by the Isle of Wight social worker that there was a police investigation ongoing. Under state guidelines, any couple wishing to adopt at the time would go through a rigorous screening process, including a home study involving 3 to 4 visits by a social worker and an extensive background check. If the parents weren't listed in a central registry of people suspected of child abuse or having a risky home environment, and if no problems were found during the home visits, the child would tentatively be placed with the family. An adoption wouldn't become final until 6 months after placement, and during those 6 months, the social worker was supposed to make several follow-up visits. You may recall from the last episode that social worker Gloria Wilson made a single follow-up visit to the Kenzia home in the 2 months following Michael's adoption. Ms. Linneberry said even though Michael's death was investigated by the police, apparently the local DSS worker did not do a Child Protective Services investigation of Michael's death, which would have placed the Kenzias in the central registry. Regarding Susan's psychiatric hospitalization immediately preceding Kevin's placement, Ms. Linneberry said that a prospective adoptive parent's mental issues should be weighed by the social worker handling the adoption.
How much of a red flag it would raise would depend on the total investigation.
She said the agency had been trying to be
less judgmental and more positive in its attitude.
I'll pause here for another sponsor break. On July 28, 1986, Dr. Gregory Wanger, the assistant chief medical examiner for the Tidewater region, released the results of Kevin's autopsy. It took over 2 months for the medical examiner to make his conclusion because he waited several weeks on toxicology tests performed on Kevin's tissues, which provided no new information. Dr. Wanger stated that while Kevin's death was suspicious, his exact cause of death could not be determined. The death was considered suspicious due to Michael's death, which the medical examiner's office also found suspicious, as well as the entirety of the case. Notably, Dr. Wanger did not list SIDS as Kevin's cause of death. Dr. Wanger's external examination of Kevin's body revealed the baby had suffered red contusions or bruises to his outer thigh and right knee. Incision into these areas found the contusions extended into the deep fat. These were, however, the only injuries 4-month-old Kevin had suffered. The only other mark of note was a bluish-black birthmark, at the time known as a Mongolian spot, on Kevin's lower back. The bruises, according to the medical examiner, were not responsible for Kevin's death. Dr. Wanger's pathological diagnosis mentioned the bruises as well as a history of sudden death, although it's unclear what that history refers to, as there's no documented history of Kevin's breathing stopping or Kevin needing to be revived. At the time of his death, Kevin also suffered from a middle ear infection on the right side, indicated by Dr. Wanger's finding that the right middle ear cavity was filled with thick, yellow mucus. This could easily mean nothing. Children get ear infections all the time. I just think it's worth pointing out that in known cases of Munchausen or Munchausen by proxy, it's very common for these cases to present with ear-related symptoms. 83.3% of Munchausen by proxy cases came to the attention of an ENT specialist through some reported problem with the patient's ear. The autopsy also found thymic petechiae, or pinpoint red spots on the thymus, which is a little gland in the chest that is part of the lymphatic system. These petechiae are often, but not always, found in SIDS deaths. The only thing is that in SIDS deaths, thymic petechiae are almost always found along with pleural and epicardial petechiae, and in Kevin's case, the tiny hemorrhages were only found in the thymus. With the help of family members, I was able to get the perspective of an advanced practice registered nurse with both a bachelor's and a master's degree in nursing with a concentration in pediatric health, who reviewed the boys' autopsies. She thought Kevin's death may be consistent with SIDS based on the thymic petechiae. She did, however, point out some microscopic findings that she said were nonspecific but can sometimes be found in asphyxia deaths, including Dr. Wanger's findings of moderate congestion and focal edema in the lungs, focal petechial hemorrhages in the spleen, moderate congestion in the liver, and severe congestion in the kidneys and adrenal gland. These are not gotcha findings, but they certainly are interesting. While preparing for this episode, I reached out to famed forensic pathologist Dr. Cyril Wecht, who has served as the president of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences and the American College of Legal Medicine. Dr. Wecht has been involved in investigations or consultations of such famous deaths as President John F. Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy, Sharon Tate, Elvis Presley, Kurt Cobain, JonBenet Ramsey, the Branch Davidian incident in Waco, Texas, Lacey Peterson, Anna Nicole Smith and her son Daniel, and Rebecca Zehow. Dr. Wecht has performed over 14,000 autopsies in his career. He is a rock star in the forensic community and has appeared in countless television shows and documentaries. Imagine my utter shock when I heard back from Dr. Wecht, who agreed to review Michael and Kevin's autopsies. I will not lie, I had an extended fangirl moment before sending over the information he requested. Unfortunately, Dr. Wecht was unable to arrive at any solid conclusions after reviewing the boys' autopsies. He said that the cases were
too far in the distant past to permit the kind of study required to determine cause of death and manner of death.
After releasing the autopsy findings in July of 1986, Dr. Wanger told the Daily Press,
"We have not been able to rule in or rule out all of the possibilities suggested."
He added that only a
very small percentage of deaths come back as undetermined.
Commonwealth's attorney Parker Counsel said he had expected the findings because the medical examiner had warned him to expect an undetermined cause of death even before the grand jury convened to consider Susan's indictment. Counsel said,
"I was expecting the cause to be undetermined. I was hoping for more, but it didn't happen."
Smithfield Police Lieutenant Charles Phelps, the chief investigator in the Kenzie case, told the newspaper that he, too, had expected the medical examiner's conclusion and conceded that Kevin's autopsy results would make a conviction more difficult to obtain. He was confident, however, in the other evidence they had collected against Susan, adding,
"We have witnesses who can testify to a pattern of abuse by her."
Susan herself declined to comment. In November of 1986, defense attorney Usner filed a motion in Isle of Wight Circuit Court to separate the trials for the two murder charges, telling the court that trying both charges at the same time
would work an injustice and be highly prejudicial to her because of the evidence which may be introduced as to one charge being inadmissible as to the other, if tried together.
Usner claimed the charges were not connected as to place or time, never mind the fact that the baby's deaths were a mere 9 months apart and occurred in the same house, and that he didn't want them tied together. Usner also planned to file several more motions the following week, including one requiring the Commonwealth to explain its theory of how and why Susan murdered her adopted sons. Prosecutor Counsel said he expected the court to allow separate trials, although
obviously it would be better for the Commonwealth if both were tried at the same time.
Counsel told a reporter that he wanted some evidence of one death allowed into evidence during the trial for the other. Judge E. Everett Bagnell ruled that Susan had a right to separate trials. Unfortunately, in what I believe was the death knell for the prosecution's case, Susan elected to have her cases heard by the judge in a bench trial rather than by a jury of 12 of her peers. I believe the outcome would have been very different had her case been heard by a jury. The bench trial of Susan Lee Stevenson Kenzie for the murder of her 9-month-old son, Michael, began before Judge Everett Bagnell at 10 a.m. on December 17, 1986, 3 days before Susan's 27th birthday. Because of Susan's direct indictment in July, the trial was the first time any details about the case would be revealed to the public. Susan's were the first murder charges that had been pressed in Isle of Wight County for over 2 years. Interestingly, one newspaper article mentioned that Susan coughed regularly throughout her 4-day trial, supposedly due to pneumonia. Whether or not Susan was actually sick, if this was a self-imposed illness, or if it was malingering or hypochondria, we'll never know for sure. During his opening arguments, Commonwealth's attorney Parker Counsel told the court that he believed Susan's behavior was due to Munchausen syndrome by proxy, which he said caused her to injure her baby instead of herself. Counsel said this case was different from most murder cases, especially in regard to the motive.
Motive is the tough part in a case like this. How do you come up with a reason for a parent to kill their children? It's not like the typical motive in a murder case where you have revenge, jealousy, or financial gain.
Social worker Gloria Wilson would be called to testify for both the prosecution and the defense, who were also expected to argue over what evidence from Kevin's case would be allowed into evidence during Michael's. The defense subpoenaed 16 witnesses in advance of the trial. Usner predicted that after the prosecution presented its case, Judge Bagnell would end the trial due to lack of evidence, saying,
"I don't think they've got enough to prove a crime was committed."
If the judge didn't strike the case, Usner planned to present evidence showing Michael was a sick baby who was in the hospital a week before his death on a breathing monitor. He would also try to prove that the bruises on Michael's body were caused by life-saving efforts after the baby stopped breathing. Of course, he would mention nothing about that information being based solely on Susan's accounts. Testimony in the case began with six witnesses on Wednesday, December 18, 1986. Susan, wearing a blue suit and hacking away from her so-called pneumonia, was surrounded by her defense team. One of the first witnesses was medical examiner Dr. Farooq Presswala, who conducted Michael's autopsy. Dr. Presswala testified that Michael died as a result of the stress on his heart caused by repeated injuries that left bruises all over his body. He said the bruising was too extensive to have been caused by the handful of accidents Susan and Tom reported, and he also said that attempts to revive the baby couldn't have caused the bruises, especially after Michael's heart had already stopped. Besides, the doctor's opinion was that the bruises were between 1 and 4 days old at the time of Michael's death. The greenstick fractures to Michael's 6th and 7th rear ribs could not have been caused by CPR, Dr. Presswala said. Dr. Presswala testified about conducting Michael's autopsy on August 29, 1985. In addition to the bruises he found on Michael's forehead, face, arms, back, and legs, Dr. Presswala also talked about Michael's mild dehydration and the other injuries he found, including bruises on the genitals, a series of puncture wounds down the right leg that would not have been inflicted due to any medical procedure, and the 2 broken ribs. Michael's autopsy report mentions
evidence of resuscitation with 2 cut-downs at the ankle, a sutured cut-down at the right femoral, needle sticks in the left femoral, needle punctures ×6 in the pericardium, needle punctures on the arms and cubital fossa, or inside of the elbow.
A cut-down is an emergency medical procedure used to expose a vein surgically when medical staff is unable to insert a needle or catheter into a peripheral vein. The cut-down incisions were evidently in addition to the puncture wounds Dr. Presswala described. Regarding Michael's cause of death, Dr. Presswala told the court that he found no injuries to the baby's major organs, but he did find microscopic evidence of damage to the heart muscle, consisting of separation of the heart fibers, which can cause an irregular heartbeat. This condition, called stress cardiomyopathy, was caused, the doctor said, by Michael receiving several injuries over a period of time. While none of the injuries would cause death by itself, the repeated injuries caused stress damage to the baby's heart. Another witness on the first day of testimony was social worker Gloria Wilson, who specialized in adoptions and foster care. On the stand, Gloria testified about Michael's placement in the Kenzia home on June 28, 1985, her home visit on July 9th, and her subsequent phone calls with Susan after that, admitting she never saw Michael alive again after that single visit. Gloria testified that the adoption agency's medical reports showed no indication that Michael had any pre-existing health conditions. She said Susan reported to her that Michael stopped breathing several times, had seizures, and showed a lack of muscle coordination. Again, no source other than Susan herself indicated firsthand knowledge that Michael had any type of central nervous system disorder. Testimony was also heard from 2 Isle of Wight Rescue Squad members who responded to 44 Riverside Drive on August 28, 1985. Diane Trier, who taught the CPR course Susan passed in 1984, said she noticed the bruises on Michael when she arrived at the Kenzia home that day. V. Alvin Batten testified that he was the first to arrive the day Michael died, and he told the court that he noticed the baby's bruises, but did not believe his life-saving efforts caused further bruising or Michael's broken rear ribs. Dr. Paul E. Turner, Jr. testified on the first day as well. Dr. Turner, an emergency room doctor at Riverside Hospital for 6 years, said he and 2 pediatricians tried for almost an hour to revive Michael when he arrived on August 28th. He said Michael was already dead when he arrived at the hospital,
and none of the things we did bruised the child.
Dr. Turner was the medical staff member who was concerned by Michael's large number of bruises and referred the case to the medical examiner for investigation. The final witness of the day was Smithfield Police Lieutenant Charles Phelps, who read Susan's 2-hour police statement from October 10, 1985, before she was considered a suspect. The lieutenant testified that at the time of Susan's interview, only her husband, Tom Kenzia, was a suspect in Michael's death. Lieutenant Phelps read from Susan's statement about how she claimed Michael's bruises were caused by various accidents, including other children striking him a number of times with the popcorn popper toy, getting hit in the face with a soccer ball that caused him to fall backward off a step, and being jumped on in the general area by a child she babysat. The popcorn popper toy and Christopher jumping on Michael were supposed to account for the bruise on Michael's genitals, but can you imagine how hard a 14-month-old toddler has to hit a baby through the padding of a diaper to bruise the baby's genitals? After this final sponsor break, I'll get into testimony from the remainder of the trial. On December 19, 1986, multiple witnesses testified to a pattern of children who stopped breathing in Susan's care, as well as other child abuse they had witnessed. The newspaper reported that Jan Bates testified. After speaking with Jan herself, I can tell you with certainty that Jan Bates and Julia Bates are the same person. Jan and Carter Bates were the parents of baby Julie Bates, whose real name is also Julia. To avoid confusion, the elder Julia goes by Jan, while the younger goes by Julie or Julia. On the stand, Jan Bates testified that 19 days before Michael died, her 7-month-old daughter, Julie, stopped breathing in Susan's care, and Susan revived her with mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. The baby was hospitalized, but doctors could not explain why Julie suddenly stopped breathing, and the problem did not recur. Susan's ex-husband, Doug Cook, dropped a bombshell, testifying that when their younger daughter, Shannon, was less than a year old in 1981, she also stopped breathing while he was at work. Susan revived Shannon, and she was briefly hospitalized. This was one of many hospitalizations for Shannon, which I'll get into in more detail in a future episode. This also brings the tally of children who stopped breathing in Susan's care up to 4. Another person who testified the same day was 15-year-old Jennifer Ford, who spent a month in the Kenzia home as a foster child in March of 1986. Jennifer testified that she witnessed Susan verbally abuse her daughters and whip them with a belt approximately once every 2 days. Jennifer also said she witnessed Susan stuff a diaper in then 2-month-old Kevin's mouth to make him stop crying. While Jennifer lived with the Kenzias, she told the court, she was
surprised, shocked
by some of the ways she saw Susan treat baby Kevin. One example she gave was during an incident at a Smithfield restaurant. Kevin was crying, Jennifer said, so Susan put him face down between her knees and squeezed until he stopped crying. Jennifer later reported the incident to a social worker. Doris Jones, a waitress at another restaurant, testified that during a visit to the restaurant, Kevin was fussy, and moments later, Doris saw the baby with a diaper stuck in his mouth. As Susan approached the cash register, Doris heard the baby choking, and after Susan saw her looking, Susan pulled a piece of disposable diaper out of Kevin's mouth. If you remember, Dr. Wanger commented in the autopsy report,
"Police investigation revealed a history of foreign material being placed in the child's mouth to control its crying."
Another witness who testified was Nancy Oliver, who ran a Newport News adoptive parents group. Nancy met Susan when she was first searching for a baby boy to adopt. Nancy kept catalogs of available children, and Susan came over to go through them. Nancy testified,
"I had some problems with the parenting I saw with her daughters,"
and did not help Susan much with her quest. Nancy also testified that 3 days before Michael died, Susan showed up at her house with 4 garbage bags full of disposable diapers and 2 grocery bags full of jars of baby food. There were multiple diaper brands, and although Michael was in diapers, Susan said she wanted Nancy to have them, saying she bought the wrong kind. Nancy told the court that during that odd visit, she became uncomfortable with the way Susan handled Michael, squeezing him so hard he gasped for air. Nancy testified that Susan said,
"If I take you to the hospital with broken ribs, doctors are never going to believe you got broken ribs from me hugging you too tight."
During the trial, witnesses also testified about how Susan was less loving of her babies than she was obsessive about them. She constantly had an eye on Michael, carried him around, and wouldn't let him out of her sight. Although this was not brought up at trial, it's infuriating that while Susan obsessively watched her boys, at the same time, her daughters were out wandering the streets, left unsupervised to the point that Shannon had been molested not once, but twice by this time. On December 19th, the Commonwealth rested its case, and Judge Bagnell overruled a defense motion to dismiss the charge due to lack of evidence that Susan inflicted the bruises on Michael. Part of his decision stemmed from the fact that there were multiple incidents of children who stopped breathing in Susan's care. However, he reduced the charge from first-degree murder to second-degree murder, giving his opinion that the killing was not premeditated. First-degree murder carried a penalty of 20 years to life. Second-degree murder would incur 5 to 20 years. The same day, the defense began presenting its case by trying to show that Michael was a sick child who could have had a birth defect because his teenage biological mother used drugs. The defense called two doctors who cared for Michael during the last month of his life at Maryview Hospital in Portsmouth, where Susan took him twice after he stopped breathing. Evidence showed that according to a hospital monitor, Michael stopped breathing once for 14 seconds during a 12-hour test, which was considered abnormal, but all other tests on his heart were negative. There were no signs of bruising on Michael at the time. Three Portsmouth pediatricians testified that Michael's medical history showed he was at risk of sudden infant death syndrome. As expected, Gloria Wilson testified, this time for the defense, saying a medical report on Michael showed he was born to an unwed teen mother who used cocaine in the first 3 months of her pregnancy. The defense also claimed the girl used marijuana. However, medical tests performed shortly after birth showed Michael was quite healthy. Prior to Kevin's adoption, Gloria said, she conducted her own investigation into Michael's death and found no signs of abuse. After seeing that baby's autopsy report myself, I have to wonder if she conducted that investigation with her eyes closed. Friday, December 20th, 1986, was the final day of Susan's trial for the murder of her first adopted son, and on that day, the only person who took the stand was Susan Kenzia herself, who testified for 3 hours, never straying from her story that Michael was sickly and died from respiratory failure. Susan told the court how difficult it was for her white family to adopt a biracial baby. I was surprised to read that because by all other accounts, including her own previous tellings of the story, the Kenzias deliberately sought out biracial babies so they had a better chance of finding the boy they wanted. She testified about the family's trip to Disney World in June of 1985 when they picked Michael up from Maryland and drove south to Florida. During that trip, Susan said, she immediately noticed that Michael was stiff and hard to hold and that he didn't cuddle. Sometimes, she said, he was very stiff. In others, he was
floppy. I thought there was something wrong with Michael. I thought he had cerebral palsy.
Susan even produced before the court stacks of telephone bills to document the many long-distance phone calls she made to doctors and other professionals before Michael's adoption, supposedly attempting to unravel his medical history. To my knowledge, and from everything I've found in my research, Susan never met Michael prior to June 28, 1985. If so, she was basing her opinion on the photographs Gloria Wilson sent her. In those photos, Michael looks perfectly healthy to me. Michael, Susan said, lacked coordination and wasn't a good eater, and she said his toes stayed curled up. When he tried to pull himself up using furniture, she said,
every time I turned around, the child was falling on his face.
It's probably pertinent to point out that she only cared for Michael between the ages of 7 months and 9 months. So it stands to reason that he wouldn't be an expert on standing just yet. Also, in her police interview, Susan told Lieutenant Phelps and Special Agent Colton that Dr. Cox told her that Michael's motor development was that of a 6-month-old, not a 9-month-old. In that case, he wouldn't likely be able to pull himself up to standing at all, so he wouldn't have the opportunity to fall and hurt himself. As for the bruises covering Michael's body, Susan told the court that they were caused by household accidents and fights with the other children she babysat for, despite Dr. Preswala's insistence to the contrary. The only time Susan lost her composure on the stand was when she described her attempts to revive Michael after the apnea monitor sounded on August 28th. She said she tried mouth to mouth, but the air didn't seem to go into Michael's lungs. CPR also failed, and she said she eventually began hitting Michael's chest, hoping to get his heart restarted.
I was trying to save him. I would not hurt Michael in any way. I wasn't trying to be gentle with my son. I was trying to save his life.
When the prosecution questioned Susan about why she gave away bags of diapers and baby food, Susan explained that it was because Nancy Oliver had 8 children and often took in foster children. Since Michael wouldn't eat the food and had outgrown the diapers, she said, she thought Nancy could use them. After the defense rested its case, Judge Bagnell prepared to announce his decision. He said that in his opinion, the Commonwealth had not discredited the statement Susan made to police on October 10, 1985. As for the prosecution's evidence, he said, some of it indicated that Susan intended to kill Michael, while other evidence indicated the opposite, that she was a caring, doting parent. That is literally a hallmark of Munchausen by proxy murders. In my belief, Susan only intended to kill her babies temporarily. That is, she wanted to revive them with CPR and paint herself as a hero. In a case consisting largely of circumstantial evidence, Judge Bagnell said, all of the evidence must be consistent with guilt and inconsistent with innocence to produce a verdict of guilty.
As a whole, it has to preclude every reasonable hypothesis of innocence.
Judge Bagnell announced his decision, declaring that Susan Lee Stevenson Kenzia was acquitted of murder in the death of her adopted son, Michael. When the verdict was announced, Susan leapt up from her seat and threw herself into the arms of her attorney, Ken Usner, both of them weeping. Several friends present in the courtroom yelled with joy as they rushed to Susan's side. After the decision was made, Susan had no comment for the media. Her mother, Betty Stevenson, said,
"Praise God, thank you, Jesus. I knew you would do it."
The day after the trial, Commonwealth's attorney Parker Counsel told a reporter he was unsure if he would follow through with prosecuting Susan for Kevin's murder, explaining that
it's a very different case.
In Michael's death, Counsel said, he relied on the autopsy report that concluded Michael had died from stress to his heart caused by repeated stress and trauma, but in Kevin's case, his cause and manner of death remained undetermined. Speaking with a reporter by phone, Ken Usner, the proverbial smug, smarmy defense attorney, said of Susan's charge in Kevin's death,
"Their next case cannot stand the light of day. They have nothing."
He claimed Susan was just the victim of
small-town thinking.
As for her acquittal, Usner said,
"We are relieved, but the not guilty verdict didn't tell us anything we didn't already know. I swear to God, Susan Kenzia did not do this."
Usner claimed that Susan passed 12 polygraphs before the trial, which leads me to wonder who was administering, not to mention paying for, all of these polygraphs, which weren't then, and still aren't now, admissible in court anyway. Usner said,
"She didn't just pass it, she ate it up."
Usner said the secrecy of adoption agencies was to blame for Susan's charges, saying the agencies failed to give Susan family backgrounds and full medical histories on Michael and Kevin before she adopted them. Had she received that information, he said, it may have given a fuller picture of both children's physical ailments that he believed contributed to their deaths. Even though Dr. Preswala insisted Michael's bruises were not produced by accidental or natural means, Usner said Michael's physical ailments could account for the bruises. For the record, cerebral palsy does not cause bruises in and of itself. Further, trying to prove Susan's innocence, Usner said his client took the baby to several doctors to determine what his problem was. I'd just like to point out here that mysterious, undiagnosable medical problems along with visits to multiple doctors can be a strong indication of Munchausen syndrome by proxy. Susan also spoke to a reporter, saying,
"I'm relieved that the judge found me not guilty in the sense that it's over, but I've known all along that I was innocent."
She said that even though she was found not guilty, she would never again adopt a baby or care for small children, saying the risk of doing so was far too great. Her actual quote to the reporter was,
"Nobody could have taken better care of Michael and Kevin than I did, and they're both dead."
2 weeks later, on January 5, 1987, prosecutor counsel moved to dismiss the second murder charge against Susan without prejudice. Judge Bagnell, again citing lack of evidence, accepted the prosecutor's motion. Counsel said,
"I think the evidence shows that it's very unlikely that these two deaths were natural or accidental. You don't like to end the case with matters unresolved, but a trial wouldn't resolve the matter."
Having the charge dropped wasn't good enough for Susan, who said,
"It's still hanging over my head. I would have liked to get it over with once and for all. I wanted to be acquitted."
Attorney Usner said he also wanted to see Susan cleared.
"It's not a first-class ticket home, it's a second-class ticket home. From where she sits, there's no end to this nightmare. She was just not treated fairly."
Susan said her immediate concern was her two daughters, who had been staying with her sister's family in South Carolina since her arrest the previous July. She said she planned to stay there with them until the end of the school year. As far as the reason why Kevin died, Susan said,
"It's something I'll never know. Parker Counsel and Dr. Preswala, even people who don't know me, can say anything they want. They can put me through hell, but they can't take away my memories. No matter what they put me through, they can't touch them."
News coverage at the time mentioned Michael having pre-existing health problems, which I can't stress enough was based solely on Susan's word. I haven't seen a stitch of evidence anywhere proving there was anything wrong with either baby prior to his death other than Susan's statements. This two-minute story aired on News 3 after the second murder charge was dropped.
Susan Kenzia will not be tried for murder in the death last May of her second adopted son. The 27-year-old Smithville woman was acquitted last month in the August 1985 death of her first adopted son. And News 3 reporter Bruce Berry says the court agreed to drop the second case.
On December 19th, the verdict was innocent after 3 days of testimony about nine-month-old Michael, who had serious medical problems but died with bruises on his body. Today, on the recommendation of Prosecutor Parker Counsel, the court null cross a murder charge in the death of four-month-old Kevin. That means the charges could be refiled, but Susan's attorney says it isn't likely.
The effect on her is that she will not stand trial for it. And I don't think Commonwealth is going to bring the case back up.
The state dropped the second case because the evidence would be much the same as in the first trial. The defense believed the second case was even weaker than the first. The accused believes there was no case.
I was charged because the second child died in my home. That's the reason I lost the all.
Susan Kenzia says she feels little relief over her acquittal and the dropped charge. She will try to start her life again one day at a time. She plans to leave Smithfield, but not just because of what the neighbors might say.
People don't believe what they want to believe. It's hard for me to answer because the people that know me, the people that really know me, know that I didn't do anything to my sons. They know just how bad I wanted them.
Susan Kenzia says the worst part of her ordeal will never end. And it wasn't the arrest or the charges or the 11 days she spent in jail or even the trial. It was the loss of her two sons and the fact that nothing will ever bring Michael or Kevin back. In Smithfield, Bruce Barry, News 3.
The day after the decision was made to drop the charge, on January 6, 1987, Tom and Susan Kenzia officially separated. Soon afterward, Susan moved to South Carolina. Tom, who had adopted Christy and Shannon years before, continued to have visitation with the girls until the summer of 1989. After the trial, Susan worked at the law office of Usner and Hardwick for a while to help pay off some of the attorney's fees she had accrued throughout the process. This detail and their creepy relationship is serving me strong Casey Anthony and Jose Baez vibes. At this point, I'm briefly going to jump quite a ways ahead in the timeline of this story. In early June of 2000, attorney Kenneth A. Usner was involved in a vehicle accident on New Jersey's Garden State Parkway. Usner was standing behind his Jeep Cherokee on the shoulder of the parkway, getting ready to change a tire, when another car struck him, causing severe injuries to his legs. As a result of the accident, on June 4, 2000, Usner suffered a heart attack. He remained in a coma at the Hackensack University Medical Center for almost a month. After the accident, New Jersey State Police searched Usner's vehicle and found a whole lot of incriminating contraband, including a handgun, a rifle, a shotgun, bullets, two knives, four glassine bags of heroin, and computer-generated child pornography. A search warrant executed by the Virginia State Police on June 9, 2000, at Usner's condo in Hampton's Mill Point community turned up even more damning evidence that contributed to the investigation of Mr. Usner for possible interstate trafficking of child pornography. In light of these revelations, I couldn't resist putting this together, and I feel like it's appropriate right here.
Okay, Beck. Thank you, baby. Go ahead, Beck. Okay, baby?
Yeah, baby.
Okay, hon. Thank you, dear. Okay, sure. Talk to you, baby. Don't go get in front of me in jail. Okay, smile. I can't hear it. Okay, baby? Talk to you later, sure, baby.
I can't hear you, honey.
Okay, sure.
Hey, honey?
I'm here, honey.
Yeah, baby. Talk to you shortly, sugar.
Yeah, honey.
Love you, honey.
No, don't be okay. Where's your smile?
Well, I've lost 18 pounds over you. You can't do that.
Okay, honey?
You got my full attention, too.
Need you out, baby.
Hey, baby.
Where's your smile?
Oh, sugar, bud.
Talk to you shortly, cutie.
Okay, baby.
Due to his comatose state, Usner was never charged with any crimes related to the investigation. Instead, on July 3rd, the former military cop, retired Army colonel, decorated Vietnam War veteran, and alleged pervert, died of complications from his heart attack. Usner was survived by his former wife, Sheila, his daughter, Catherine, and his sons, Kenneth II and Craig. He was predeceased by his parents and, I was surprised to learn, by an infant daughter, Karen Amanda Usner, who died on April 5, 1977. In another of her personal writings at some point after the trial, Susan wrote,
"I once vowed I would never babysit again, but I can't stop being me. I love kids. I can't stop being who I am because of the hell I went through."
Unfortunately, that means exactly what you're probably thinking it means. Susan's list of victims would only continue to grow. Susan's surviving children, 8-year-old Christy and 6-year-old Shannon, were never interviewed by police, social workers, psychologists, or anyone else. Despite Shannon's constant unexplained illnesses, despite 2 dead babies in the home, despite 4 children going into respiratory arrest while in Susan's care, and despite the presence of countless other warning signs, even though the specter of Munchausen syndrome by proxy came up at the trial, no one bothered to look in on Susan's biological children. If they had, they may have realized that Susan was very likely poisoning one of her own daughters, subjecting her to unnecessary medical visits, procedures, and surgeries, and at one point convincing the little girl that she was terminally ill. If you thought this story so far has sounded a little bit like that of Mary Beth Tinning, hold on tight for next week. We're entering Dee Dee Blanchard territory. In next week's episode, I'll walk you through the 28 years of sheer hell lived by Susan's younger daughter, Shannon, the variety of doctors she saw and the countless undiagnosable maladies she suffered, and how Susan's medical meddling sent her down a path of self-destruction. My sources for Part 1 and Part 2 were the Newport Daily News, the Richmond Times, the Times Herald, the Virginian Pilot, the Scrofano Law website, the American Journal of Diseases of Children, the National Library of Medicine, WebMD, Wikipedia, the Rock Hill Herald, court documents, transcripts, audio recordings, and personal accounts. That's it for Part 2 of Groomed to Die, The Kenzia Children, the first ever Suffer the Little Children podcast miniseries. Join me next week for Part 3. If you like the show, please follow or subscribe to Suffer the Little Children on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, YouTube, Spotify, Spreaker, Pandora, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast listening app. And please leave me a 5-star rating and a positive review on your favorite podcast platform. Visit the website at sufferthelittlechildrenpod.com. To help support the show, you can visit patreon.com/stlcpod or ko-fi.com/stlcpod. Follow the podcast on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Pinterest at Suffer the Little Children Pod, and on Twitter and TikTok at STLCPod. View photos related to today's episode on Facebook. For more stories like the one you heard today, visit sufferthelittlechildrenblog.com. This podcast is researched, written, hosted, edited, and produced by Lane. All music for the show is licensed from audiojungle.net. For more information about preventing or reporting child abuse, visit childhelp.org or call your area's child abuse hotline. And remember, if you see something, say something.